piece of wax. It can record and reproduce any sort of color or movement of any physical body with the aid of a piece of glass and a strip of celluloid. It can build a machine that will travel in the air, on or under the water, or on the ground. It can build a machine that will plow its way through the thickest forest, smashing trees as though they were corn stalks. It can build a shovel that will lift as many tons of dirt in a minute as 10 men could move in a day. It can harness the magnetic poles of the northern and the southern portions of the earth with the aid of a compass and determine direction accurately. And yet, with all this miraculous power, the majority of the people of the world permit themselves to be cowed by fears of difficulties which do not exist save in their own imaginations. The arch enemy of mankind is fear. We fear poverty in the midst of an overabundance of riches. We fear ill health despite the ingenious system nature has provided us with which the physical body is automatically maintained in working order. We fear criticism when there are no critics save that which we set up through our own imaginations. We fear the loss of love of friends and relatives, although we know well enough that our own conduct is sufficient to maintain love through all ordinary circumstances of human relationships. We fear old age, whereas we should accept it as a medium of greater wisdom and understanding. We fear the loss of liberty, although we know that liberty is a matter of harmonious relationship with others. We fear death, when we know it is inevitable, therefore beyond our control. We fear failure, not recognizing that every failure carries with it the seed of an equivalent benefit. And we fear the lightning until Franklin and Edison and a few other rare individuals who dared to take possession of their own minds proved that it was nothing but a form of energy which can be harnessed and used for the benefit of mankind. Instead of opening our minds for the guidance of infinite intelligence through faith, we close our minds tightly with every conceivable shade and degree of limitation based upon our unnecessary fears. We know that man is the master of every other living thing on earth, yet we fail to look about us and learn from the birds of the air and the beasts of the jungle that even the dumb animals have been wisely provided with food and the necessities of their existence through the divine plan which makes all fear unnecessary. We complain of lack of opportunity and cry out against those who dare to take possession of their own minds, not recognizing that every man who has a sound mind has the right and the power to provide himself with every material thing he needs or can use. We fear the discomfort of pain, not recognizing that pain is a universal language through which man is warned of evils that need correction. Because of our fears, we go to the Creator with prayers over petty details we could and should settle for ourselves, then give up and lose faith when we do not get the results we ask for, not recognizing our duty to offer prayers of thanks for the blessings we already possess. We talk and preach sermons about sin, failing to recognize that the greatest of all sins is that of loss of faith in an all-wise Creator, who has provided his children with more blessings than any earthly parent ever thinks of providing for his own children. We convert the revelations of invention into tools of destruction through what we politely call war. Then we cry out in protest when the law of compensation properly punishes us with a depression. We speak of the animals of the jungle as dumb beasts, failing to recognize that despite their dumbness, they do not engage in wars and have no depressions. We profane our minds with envy, greed, avarice, jealousy, lust, and fear, then wonder why faith does not bestow its beneficence upon us, not recognizing that faith will no more fraternize with these states of mind than will oil and water mix. You ask me, how may one develop faith? I'll tell you how. Faith may be developed by clearing the mind of its enemies, clear the mind of negative thoughts and fears and self-imposed limitations, and lo, faith has filled the place without effort. If you cannot take my word for this, try it for yourself and be forever convinced. I repeat, there is no great mystery about the state of mind known as faith. Give it a place to dwell, and it will move in without ceremony or invitation. Stop talking about faith and start practicing it. What could be more simple? Who is so short-sighted as not to recognize the simplicity and the soundness of the approach to faith I have described? We preach sermons and offer up prayers in the name of God, yet we rarely make more than a gesture at following his admonition for us to liquidate our problems through the simple state of mind known as faith. We build great edifices of worship in the name of God, yet we profane them with minds that are steeped in fear and self-imposed limitations, which he clearly promised us we need not endure. If I seem to speak plainly, be assured it is because I feel that mankind needs the quickening influence of plain speech to shock people into recognizing that everything they need or want is already within their grasp. All they need to do is to take possession of their own minds and use them. To do this, man has no one to consult except himself. The approach to liberty, freedom and abundance of the material necessities and luxuries of life is through the individual's mind. This mind is the only thing over which he has complete control, yet it is the one thing he so seldom uses intelligently. Take my message to the students of the philosophy of achievement. Translate it for them in the same burning words in which I have delivered it to you. Never mind about those who will not agree with me, but deliver the message unabridged for the benefit of those who are ready to hear the truth and are willing to appropriate and use it. Once in a great while, the world is blessed by the presence of one who takes control of his mind and uses it for the good of mankind. Then it has found a genius, an Edison, an Aristotle, a Plato, or a great leader in thought and in action in some field of useful endeavor. Marconi took possession of his own mind and used it to reveal the principle of wireless communication. Edison's mind gave the world the incandescent electric lamp and 100 other useful devices for the benefit of mankind. Copernicus and Bruno took possession of their minds and gave the world the telescope and a look into the starry heaven, millions of miles beyond the range of the unaided human eye. Columbus took possession of his mind and gave us a new world, which now serves as the last frontier of human liberty and freedom. Orville and Wilbur Wright took possession of their minds and gave man wings and mastery of the air. Johann Gutenberg took possession of his mind and gave us movable type, and thereby made possible every book we possess and gave us the means of preserving the accumulated experience of mankind for the benefit of the yet unborn generations. Robert Fulton took possession of his mind and gave us mastery of the seas through the steamboat. Henry Ford took possession of his own mind and gave us a dependable vehicle of rapid transportation at a price within reach of the humblest person. Theodore Roosevelt took possession of his mind and gave us the Panama Canal, providing a valuable measure of protection for our shores against attack by enemies from other countries. Eli Whitney took possession of his mind and gave a measure of economic security to the people of the southern states through the perfection of the modern cotton gin. Stephen Foster took possession of his mind temporarily and gave us songs that enrich our souls. Emerson took possession of his mind and enriched the world with his essays on compensation, self-reliance, and other subjects. Newton took possession of his mind and revealed the law of gravitation that keeps the stars and planets properly related and confined to their accustomed places in the universe. Samuel Adams, John Hancock, and Richard Henry Lee took possession of their minds and inspired the movement which gave America its boasted liberty of thought and freedom of action. Omar Khayyam took possession of his mind and gave the world through the Rubaiyat great poetic thought. Samuel Morse took possession of his mind and gave the world the modern system of telegraphy. And Alexander Graham Bell took possession of his mind and gave us the modern telephone. Cyrus McCormick took possession of his mind and gave us the reaper, with its manifold benefits to agriculture. James J. Hill took possession of his mind and brought the East and West into easy accessibility to one another through a great railway system. And, if I may be pardoned for personal references to my own work, I had to take possession of my own mind to give America the United States Steel Corporation. These are well-known examples of self-reliance based on faith. Let us learn from these outstanding examples of achievement one great lesson we all need to know, and that is the obvious fact that self-reliance and faith are based on definiteness of purpose, backed by definite plans of action. The best way to start developing faith is by choosing an objective and beginning at once to attain it through whatever media available. Procrastination and faith have nothing in common. Our greatest weakness is our failure to take possession of our minds and use them. Let us hope that someday and soon, some person, perhaps some unknown person, will come up from obscurity, will arise, take possession of his own mind, and inspire the American people to make a fuller and better use of the great American privilege of liberty and freedom that we possess. Somewhere in the United States, that person may now be preparing himself for this very job. Perhaps he is being tested through hardship, disappointment, and discouragement, as practically all other great leaders of thought have been conditioned for their work. And still other unknowns may yet come forth from the great American melting pot and inspire the people to make better use of the abundance of opportunities with which they have been blessed. Through the leadership of these as yet unknown men, we will be given a more practical system of education, a more practical application of religion, common decency in the field of politics, greater safety in automobile and airplane traffic, better working relationships between employers and employees, improved methods of farming and marketing farm products, an effective antidote against the growing evil of alcoholic drink, better public health facilities for all our people, a cure for the common cold, a cure for cancer, a workable plan for settling international disputes without resort to war, a more effective control of crime, and a workable plan for eliminating many of our present criminal factors through preventative measures, a more equitable distribution of the tax burden, more effective means of collecting taxes economically, ways and means of eliminating waste in governmental management, schools of diplomacy and statesmanship in which men who seek public office will be prepared for their duties, cheaper and better homes and adequate housing for every citizen, new and cheaper fuel for automobiles, an advertising department for every state to publicize its assets, some appropriate reward for the leaders of industry to take the place of the brickbats and epithets with which they are greeted all too often. These are but a few morsels of food for the imagination of men and women who wish to develop self-reliance through useful effort. Those who avail themselves of these and other opportunities for self-development in America must take possession of their own minds and rely upon themselves. They must accept the fact that the mind has the power to convert failures into success, that it is the master of imagination, vision, enthusiasm, initiative, and all forms of human endeavor. And they must recognize the fact that the mind can travel from one part of the universe to another at will. It grows stronger and more dependable with use. It can read nature's Bible as it has been written in the geological surfaces of the earth, and thereby accurately measure millions of years of the earth's history. It is free to all who use it. It clothes itself in the physical equivalent of its dominating thoughts. It is the unchallenged master of every living creature below the intelligence of man. It can harness and use the laws of nature in a thousand useful ways. It can analyze and interpret the contents and mass of the sun 93 million miles away through mathematical calculation and analysis of the sun's rays. In brief, the development of faith is largely a matter of understanding the astounding power of the mind as the source of that power that has been revealed through these and other unquestionable sources of evidence. One of man's difficulties in connection with the understanding of faith has been the fallacy of clothing it in mystery, whereas the only real mystery about it is man's failure to make use of it. We have done too much preaching and too little practicing of faith. I speak from personal experience when I say that faith is a state of mind which can be acquired and used effectively and as easily as any other state of mind. It is all a matter of understanding and application. Truly, faith without works is dead. It is also impossible, for how can one express faith except by action? My early days of youth were cursed by poverty and limitation of opportunity, a fact with which all who know me are acquainted. I am no longer cursed by poverty because I took possession of my mind, and that mind has yielded to me every material thing I want and much more than I need. Faith is no patented right of mine. It is a universal power as available to the humblest person as it is to the greatest.
Your description of the possibilities of the human mind is both interesting and revealing, Mr. Carnegie. In all the reading I have done in connection with the subject of psychology and the working principles of the mind, I found nothing that approaches, even approximately, your description of the powers of the mind. Where did you acquire all this knowledge?
What knowledge I have of the powers of the mind I acquired from the greatest of all schools, the University of Life. It has been a habit of mine, extending backward over many years, to devote a certain amount of time daily to silent meditation and thought in connection with the plan and purpose and working principles of the mind. Some might call this habit getting in tune with the infinite. At any rate, it is a habit I shall continue as long as I live, and I heartily recommend it to all who wish to become better acquainted with the powers of their own minds. We have in America the finest system of public schools to be found anywhere. We have the finest buildings and the best of equipment. We have learned men and women teachers. We teach everything imaginable except the practical art of making a living through the application of the knowledge gained in school. It is my hope that the philosophy of American achievement will find its way into the public schools and become a helpful factor in eliminating this objectionable deficiency in the public school system by offering the secret of mental discipline.
Through your analysis of the powers of the mind, I have observed that you emphasized the importance of action as a means of developing self-reliance. Have you anything to add to that which you have already said on this subject, Mr. Carnegie?
Just this. There can be no perfect example of self-reliance that is not expressed in terms of action. It is true that the mind influences one's deeds, but the principle is reciprocal, for one's deeds influence one's mind. Evidence of this fact may be found in the experience of a child that is learning to walk. At first, the mind guides the steps through many wobbles and tumbles. But after a while, coordination between the mind and the movement of the legs takes place, and walking becomes almost an automatic procedure. So it is with the relationships between the mind and physical action. The mind influences action, and action influences the mind. Perfection is reached when the two become balanced in a state of complete coordination. Another example of the same principle is the musician learning to play an instrument. Perfection is attained only after physical practice establishes coordination between the mind and the movement of the fingers. In no other way can one become proficient in music. I heard an accomplished pianist say that the keyboard of the piano has been so perfectly painted in her mind that she could play as well in the dark as when she looked at the keyboard. She attained self-reliance in connection with her music in precisely the same way that one must attain self-reliance in connection with anything else, by coordination of effort between the mind and the physical body. One has no difficulty in developing faith in connection with that which one does through well-established habit, because habit is nothing more nor less than coordination between the faculties of the mind and the physical body.
Summing up the subject of faith in one sentence, then, would you say it is the art of believing by doing?
That would be a very accurate way of stating the matter. But you should emphasize the fact that the doing must become a fixed habit, as faith is a state of mind which remains only as long as it is exercised through use. You can develop a strong arm by giving it unusual regular exercise, but it will assume its regular size if the exercise is discontinued. It is the same with the mental attitude known as faith. Two words are inseparably associated with the development of faith. They are persistence and action. To these two might be added a third, repetition. Perfection in the exercise of faith is only a matter of placing persistence and action behind definiteness of purpose, with strong emphasis on the action. Here you have as simple a definition of the method of developing faith as I could offer. Examination of the definition will show that faith is within easy reach of all who will appropriate it.
Mr. Carnegie, may I assume, from all you have said on the subject of faith, that it is a state of mind which can best be attained by some form of individual action that is related to known facts or recognized realities? From your analysis of the subject of faith and your emphasis on the importance of moving with definiteness of purpose in order to achieve a desired objective, I've reached the conclusion that you believe faith can best be attained where one is inspired to action by a definite motive, based on tangible evidence of facts or a reasonable hypothesis assuming the existence of facts. Nowhere in your analysis have you indicated your belief that one can have or that one should have faith in anything one cannot comprehend through the ordinary faculties of understanding. I may have misunderstood you. Will you therefore state specifically whether or not it is your belief that anyone can have faith in something with which he is not familiar, and concerning the existence of which he is not certain?
You wish to know whether or not one may have faith in anything concerning the existence of which one does not have proof or a reasonable hypothesis of proof. The answer to this is unavoidably and definitely no. To ask one to believe in or have faith in anything one cannot comprehend through the faculty of reason would be as unreasonable as to ask a blind man who had never seen any colors to describe the colors of the rainbow. He simply could not do it. There would be no place where he could begin, no method by which he could offer description by comparison. Faith is a state of mind which can be attained only by definite action in connection with a definite motive. Desire and motive clear the mind of many negatives which must be removed before faith can be developed. If a man desires anything to be true and persists in his desire through action, he soon finds his mind opening automatically for guidance through faith, provided always that he believes he can get the object of his desire. Christians have a definite approach to an understanding of how the principle of faith works by studying the words and deeds of Christ. He did not recommend a passive attitude toward faith, but he did demonstrate its power through works, the results of which were so astounding they could be explained only through faith. Christ demonstrated the power of faith by raising the dead, walking on water, feeding the multitudes on 5 fishes. Curing the sick, and healing the blind. He asked no one to believe these things were possible through passive faith. but he made definite demonstrations through which he proved the power of an active faith backed by deeds. Here, then, is the answer to your question as how one may develop faith. First, adopt a definite purpose and create a plan for its attainment. The presence of a plan connotes action. Second, form an alliance with other people under the mastermind principle and begin at once to carry out the plan. In this stage of the procedure, the action becomes greatly intensified through the multiplicity of minds engaged in it. This is precisely the procedure followed by Christ. Third, master and apply the principle of applied faith, still more action, this being a prescribed rule of conduct that can be easily complied with if one has prepared the way adequately through the preceding steps. By the time the third step has been taken, the individual will not need further instructions on how to develop faith, for he will already possess it. I have never known of faith bringing practical results through any method other than that which I have here explained. Faith has worked in my behalf many times, but always I have done my part through some plan or some form of action on my part. I had such faith in the consummation of the organization of the United States Steel Corporation and in the object of that organization that I saw the transaction a completed reality before I made my plans known to the men who supplied the money for that corporation. But my faith was the result of weeks of careful planning and coaching of members of my mastermind group, in the part each was to play in the transaction, all of which called for the most intense action of my business career. In Hebrews chapter 11, first verse, we find this statement: faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Here we find supporting evidence of the statement that strong motive or desire may lead to the state of mind known as faith. Following this quotation from the Bible is a series of illustrations of the power of faith through deeds, thus clearly showing that the reference to faith connotes an active faith. Study the lives of all great leaders, those who are known to have been inspired by enduring faith in the attainment of their desires, and you will discover that they were men of action. I know nothing of any sort of faith that will produce desirable results without action.
Now, Mr. Carnegie, I am going to ask another very definite question. And in doing so, I want you to know, before you answer, that I am moved to ask this question only by the most profound desire for dependable knowledge, something on which I can lean with reasonable assurance of its soundness and its practicability. My question is this: how is one to have faith in infinite intelligence unless one can find reasonable proof of the existence of such a power? If there is such a power, what is its source? Where does it exist? How may one avail oneself of this power, if it exists?
Evidence of the existence of infinite intelligence is so abundant that its existence is the easiest thing in the world to prove. I hold here in my hand an ordinary watch which measures time accurately. I know who made the watch. I understand the principle of its operation. I know something of the metal of which it is made, even down to the molecules of that metal. I also know that if I take the parts of this watch, disassociate them from their organized relationship to each other, put them in my hat and shake them, they would not and could not reassemble themselves into the working machine we know as a watch, not even if they were shaken aimlessly for millions of years. The watch operates accurately only because there is organized intelligence and a definite plan for its operation back of it. I know with equal faith that there is an organized master intelligence back of the marvelous plan of operation of the universe. I sincerely trust this answers your questions satisfactorily. The only additional suggestion I can offer, which may be of help to you and the students of the philosophy of individual achievement, is this: faith in infinite intelligence is something every man must acquire for himself, and the only practical method of doing so is that which I have described, by close examination of the perceivable evidences of its existence, as they are available through the known facts and realities of that portion of the world about us with which we are familiar, and by meditation, analysis, and thought. I would stress the importance of silent meditation. Through this form of thought, one quickens the subconscious mind and makes it more active in serving as a connecting link between the conscious mind of man and infinite intelligence. In this statement may be found the clue by which many people may discover how to take possession of their own minds. In the hurry and rush of this materialistic age, most people are apt to neglect the all-important habit of communing with themselves through silence. Every person should have a definite period of not less than 1 hour out of every 24, during which he confines his mind to introspective analysis of himself and his relationship to the world in which he lives. This form of meditation will yield stupendous dividends of knowledge, and it will lead to an easy acceptance of the reality of the fact that every mind is but a tiny reflection of infinite intelligence. Here I must leave the subject of infinite intelligence with you and the students of this philosophy. I have given you all the information on the subject that I possess. From this point, you and all others who acquire a workable understanding of faith must accept the responsibility strictly on your own. Whatever additional information you wish, you must seek within your own minds, through meditation and thought.
Analysis of Chapter 1 by Napoleon Hill. From Mr. Carnegie's analysis of the subject of faith, it becomes obvious that the state of mind known as faith is something that can be attained only by a proper conditioning of the mind, by clearing it of all negative thoughts. On this point, he is very definite. After the mind has been cleared of negative thoughts, there are three simple steps one must take in creating the state of mind known as faith, viz. 1. Form a definite desire based upon an appropriate motive for its attainment. 2. Create a definite plan for the attainment of the desire. 3. Begin action in carrying out the plan, subordinating all other endeavors to its successful attainment. These steps, persistently pursued, will take one as far as one can go alone. From there on, the subconscious mind must be relied upon to take over one's plans and carry them out to their logical conclusion, or one must substitute entirely new plans for the attainment of one's objective. When I speak of conditioning one's mind for the successful development of faith, I have reference to the complete elimination of all fear, doubt, and indecision. The conditioning process begins always with definiteness of purpose based on a burning desire for its achievement. Faith is a state of mind wherein one temporarily sets aside his own reason and willpower and opens his mind completely for the guidance of infinite intelligence, for the attainment of some definite desire. The guidance takes place in the form of an idea or a plan that is presented to the conscious mind through the faculty of imagination. Action is an essential of faith. Words without deeds will be fruitless. Hence, desire should be accompanied by a definite plan for the attainment of its objective. If the first plan adopted proves to be unsound, supplant it with another, and continue doing this until the right plan is found. Persistence must accompany action. The object of one's desire must, to induce the state of mind known as faith, be so definite that one can see it as an already attained reality. Instead of praying for the object of the desire, reverse this rule and give thanks for having already received it. Repeat this procedure daily. Never mind what your reason tells you is the impracticability of this procedure. Remember, you have temporarily overridden your faculty of reason in order to give infinite intelligence an opportunity to guide you. Unless you can carry out this instruction willingly, you have not subordinated your reason to the higher power of infinite intelligence. Remember this, and be guided accordingly. Faith, said a great philosopher, is the courage of the mind which plunges ahead and is confident of finding truth. This faith is not the enemy of reason, but rather its torch. It is the faith of Christopher Columbus and Galileo, demanding proof and counterproof. Provando e riprovando, the only faith possible at the present time. This procedure places one's religious strength squarely back of one's desires, and thereby hands the problem over to the Creator. When the solution of the problem comes, as come it will if one relies entirely upon faith for guidance, it will come in the form of an idea or plan that will be presented to the conscious mind. The soundness of the plan and the authenticity of its source will be manifested by the intensity of enthusiasm that accompanies it. When the plan comes, act on it at once. Repetition of thought in connection with the object of one's desires is the secret of success. The subconscious mind comes, finally, to accept and act upon any idea submitted to it repeatedly in the form of a definite desire. Never mind how this is done. Do your part by following these instructions with the same simplicity of faith with which a child follows the direction of its parents, and you will not be disappointed. It is not your responsibility, nor anyone's, to demand of infinite intelligence an explanation as to how it works or why. Your responsibility ends with the faithful carrying out of these instructions. This suggested procedure has nothing whatsoever to do with any dogma or creed. It does not interfere in the slightest with any religion, although it has much in common with all religions founded on the power of faith. If your plans do not mature when you expect them to, repeat the procedure here recommended until they do yield results. If you have faith, you cannot fail, provided, of course, your objective is right and sound. To doubt this is the equivalent of doubting the power of the Creator. The working principle of faith is as definite and as precise as the power that holds the stars and planets suspended in space. It cannot fail if you open your mind completely for its guidance. To carry out these instructions, you need no permission. The only help you need is that which you may receive from your own conscience. Make sure, however, that your conscience serves as your guide and not as your conspirator. In carrying out these instructions, be willing to do your part. Decide what you want, create a plan for attaining it, then move at once to put the plan into operation. If you receive a hunch to change or modify your plan, act on it. Remember that infinite intelligence may have better plans than any you can create. Give it the benefit of the doubt. If it presents to your mind a better plan than the one you have adopted, you will recognize the superior plan by the impulse of enthusiasm which will accompany it. Do not expect infinite intelligence to bring you the physical equivalent of that which you desire. Be satisfied with a plan with which you can acquire the object of your desires through the recognized rules of human relationship. Do not look for miracles. Infinite intelligence works through natural laws, using the most available means for carrying out your desires. Do not expect something for nothing. Be willing to give an equivalent value for all that you desire, and include in your plans a definite provision for doing so. Do not desire something to which you are not rightfully entitled. Infinite intelligence frowns on the cutting of corners and sharp practices. Anything you acquire by such practices will be of no enduring value to you. Examine your motives and desires carefully to make sure they contemplate no injustices to others. Injustice sets up a counterforce of opposition that will be stronger than your desire. Unjust motives may appear to prevail for the moment, but eventually they can bring only disaster. Evidence of this truth may be found in the history of every person who has started out to conquer the world. Apparently, the Creator has no need for world conquerors, or else someone would have succeeded. Place yourself on the right side at the beginning by planning to give an equivalent value for everything you expect to receive. If you neglect to observe this instruction, do not blame your failure on the lack of the power of faith. Blame it on your own lack of understanding faith. Faith is the strongest power known to man, but no one has known of this or any other power ever having caused any natural law to be suspended. Do not, therefore, expect faith to give you any advantage based on injustice to others, and do not expect it to give you something for nothing, or something for less than its value. All the evidence available to man indicates definitely that such expectations are not in harmony with the Creator's will. Be generous in giving credit to those who cooperate with you. The Creator may not demand this, but those who lend you their cooperation will appreciate it. Selfishness and greed are not related to faith. Neither are vanity and super-selfish egotism. Humility of the heart is definitely related to faith. To be truly great, one must first be sincerely humble. Personal pride often is vanity or super-selfish egotism misnamed. Be careful, therefore, of all plans based on what you may believe to be personal pride, lest they contain an element of irritation that will antagonize others and attract their unfriendly opposition. Be definite in your plans. Be persistent in their pursuit. Be courageous and self-reliant. But also be mindful of the rights and feelings of others, and express this state of mind in a spirit of true humility if you expect friendly cooperation from other people. How I discovered evidence of the power of infinite intelligence. I invite you to share with me a stupendous fortune, a fortune which I had been accumulating over a long period of years without knowing that I possessed it. The strangest feature of these riches which I wish to share with you is the fact that I can profit most by sharing them with others. I began unconsciously to accumulate this wealth when I entered the oldest of all colleges, the College of Adversity. During the Business Depression, I took a postgraduate course in this college. It was then that I uncovered my hidden fortune. I made the discovery one morning when notice came that my bank had closed its doors, possibly never again to be opened, for it was then that I began to take inventory of intangible and unused assets. Come with me while I describe what the inventory disclosed. Let us begin with the most important item on the list, faith. When I looked into my own heart, I found that, despite my financial loss, I had left an abundance of faith in infinite intelligence and in my fellow men. Along with this discovery came another of greater importance, the discovery that with faith one can accomplish that which not all the money in the world can achieve. When I was possessed of all the money I needed, I made the grievous error of believing money to be a permanent source of power. Now came the astonishing revelation that money, without faith, is but so much inert matter, and of itself possessed of no power whatsoever. Realizing, perhaps for the first time in my life, the stupendous power of enduring faith, I analyzed myself very carefully to determine just how much of this form of riches I possessed. I began by taking a walk into the woods. I wanted to get away from the crowd, away from the noise of the city, away from the disturbances of civilization, so I could meditate and think. On my journey, I picked up an acorn and held it in the palm of my hand. I found it at the roots of a giant oak tree from which it had fallen. I judged the age of the tree to be so great that it must have been a fair-sized tree when George Washington was a small boy. As I stood there looking at that great tree and its small embryonic offspring which I held in my hand, I realized that the tree had grown from a small acorn. I realized, too, that all the men living on the earth could not together build a tree like that one. I was conscious of the fact that some form of intangible intelligence had caused the acorn, from which the tree had sprung, to germinate and grow. I picked up a handful of black soil and covered the acorn with it. I now held in my hand the equivalent of the visible portion of the sum and substance out of which that magnificent tree had grown. I could see and feel the soil and the acorn, but I could neither see nor feel the intelligence which had created a great tree out of these simple substances. But I had faith that such intelligence existed. Moreover, I knew it to be a form of intelligence such as no living being possessed. At the root of the giant oak, I plucked a fern. Its leaves were beautifully designed, yes, designed. And I realized as I looked at the fern that it too was created by the same intelligence which had produced the oak tree. I continued my walk in the woods until I came to a running brook of clear, rippling water. By this time I was tired, so I took a seat near the brook that I might rest and listen to its rhythmic music as it danced on its way back to the sea. The experience brought back sweet memories of my youth when I had played by the side of a similar brook. As I sat there listening to the music of that little stream, I became conscious of an unseen being, an intelligence which spoke to me from within, and told me the enchanting story of water. And this is the story. Water. Pure, cool water. The same water that has been rendering service ever since this planet cooled off and became the home of man, beast, and vegetation. Water. Ah, what a story you could tell if you spoke man's language. You have quenched the thirst of endless millions of earthly wayfarers. You have fed the flowers. You have expanded into steam and have turned the wheels of man's machinery, condensing and going back again into your original form. You have cleaned the sewers and have washed the pavements, returning to your source, there to purify yourself and start all over again. When you move, you travel in one direction only, toward the great oceans from whence you came. You are forever going and coming, but you seem always to be happy at your labor. Water. Clean, pure, sparkling water. No matter how much dirty work you perform, you cleanse yourself at the end of your labors. Imperishable water. You cannot be created, nor can you be destroyed. You are akin to life. Without your beneficence, no form of life could exist. I had heard a great sermon, a sermon which yielded to me the secret of the music of the running brook. I had seen and felt added evidence of that same intelligence which created the great oak tree from a tiny acorn. The shadows of the trees were becoming longer. The day was coming to an end. As the sun slowly lowered itself beyond the western horizon, I realized that it, too, had played a part in that marvelous sermon which I had heard. Without the beneficent aid of the sun, there could have been no conversion of the acorn into an oak tree. Without the sun's help, the sparkling water of the flowing brook would have remained eternally imprisoned in the oceans, and life on this earth could never have existed. These thoughts gave a beautiful climax to the sermon I had heard, thoughts of the romantic affinity existing between the sun and water, beside which all other forms of romance seemed incomparable. I picked up a small white pebble which had been neatly polished by the rippling water of the brook. As I held it in my hand, I received, from within, another and still more impressive sermon. The intelligence which conveyed that truth to my conscious mind seemed to say, "Behold, mortal, a miracle which you hold in your hand. I am only a tiny pebble of stone, yet I am, in reality, a small universe. I appear to be dead and motionless, but the appearance is deceiving. I am made of molecules. Inside my molecules are myriads of atoms. Inside the atoms are countless numbers of electrons which move at an inconceivable rate of speed. I am not a dead mass of stone. I am an organized group of units of ceaseless motion. I appear to be a solid, but the appearance is an illusion, for my electrons are separated from one another by a distance greater than their mass." The thought conveyed by that climax was so illuminating, it held me spellbound. For I knew that I held in my hand an infinitesimal portion of the energy which keeps the sun and stars and the little earth on which we live in their respective places. Meditation revealed to me the beautiful reality that there was law and order even in the small confines of the tiny pebble I held in my hand. I realized that within the mass of that pebble, the romance and reality of nature were affinitized. I realized, too, that within the small stone which I held in my hand, fact transcended fancy. Never before had I felt so keenly the significance of the evidence of natural law and order and purpose which are wrapped up in a tiny bit of stone. Never before had I felt myself so near the source of my faith in infinite intelligence. It was a beautiful experience out there in the midst of Mother Nature's family of trees and running brooks, where the very calmness bade my weary soul to be quiet and to look, feel, and listen while infinite intelligence unfolded to me the story of its reality. For the moment I was in another world. This was a world which knew nothing of business depressions and bank failures and struggle for existence and competition between men. Never in all my life had I previously been so overwhelmingly conscious of the real evidence of infinite intelligence, nor of the causes of my faith therein. I lingered in this newly found paradise until the evening star began to twinkle. Then reluctantly I retraced my footsteps back to the city, there to mingle once more with those who are driven by the inexorable rules of civilization in a mad scramble for existence. I am now back in my study with my books, but I am swept by a feeling of loneliness and a longing to be out there by the side of that friendly brook where, only a few hours ago, I bathed my soul in the soothing reality of infinite intelligence. Yes, I know now that my faith in infinite intelligence is real and enduring. It is not a blind faith. It is a faith based upon close examination of the handiwork of this intelligence. I had been looking for evidence of the source of my faith in the wrong direction. I had been seeking it in the deeds of men. I found it in a tiny acorn and a giant oak tree, in the leaflets of a humble fern, and in the soil of the earth, in the friendly sun which warms the earth and gives motion to the waters, in a tiny pebble of stone and in the evening star, in the silence and the calm of the great outdoors. I am moved to suggest that infinite intelligence reveals itself through silence more readily than through the boisterousness of men's struggles in their mad rush to accumulate things material. My bank account had vanished. My bank had collapsed. But I was still richer than most millionaires because I had faith. And with this, I can accumulate other bank accounts and acquire whatever I may need to sustain myself in this maelstrom of activity known as civilization. Nay, I am richer than most millionaires because I depend upon a source of inspired power which reveals itself to me from within, while many of the wealthy men find it necessary to turn for power and stimulation to the stock ticker. My source of power is as free as the air I breathe. To avail myself of it at will, I need only faith, and this I have in abundance. An experience that led to revelation of the power of faith. I shall now describe the most dramatic experience of my entire labor of research in the field of causes of success and failure. This true story is intimately associated with a type of personal experience in connection with which no one would wish to exaggerate or treat lightly any of the details. The story concerns my son Blair, the second of three sons. I have been left no choice but to relate the story, even though it is highly personal for mention. After all, I am a student of life, and my time has been and will continue to be devoted to the study of the causes by which people may avoid poverty and misery. I feel compelled to describe my experience with Blair because his entire life has, almost miraculously, provided evidence of the manner in which the law of faith can be made to work in the practical affairs of life. I shall have to go back to the time of Blair's birth to give an accurate picture of the beginning of this colorful life drama. As the story unfolds, I want you to notice that Blair's case provides evidence of the irresistible power of faith. Keep this thought in mind, and the story will be its own explanation of why I crossed the sacred threshold of family relationship for evidence with which to convey the nature and method of operation of one of nature's inexorable laws. Blair came into this world without physical ears. He did not have even the outer signs of ears, and subsequent X-ray examinations by noted physicians disclosed the fact that he did not have even as much as an opening in the skull. The doctors in attendance at his birth took me aside and told me as gently as possible that the child would never hear or speak. "He will hear," I replied, "and he will speak." What made me throw back at the doctors such a seemingly foolish challenge is something I will never know, but I can describe, and this description is important, how I felt when I did so. The feeling came over me when I heard the uncompromising opinion of finality of the doctors that nothing was impossible. For years I had been lecturing to others, telling them, without any qualifications whatever, two very definite beliefs of mine, viz. 1. With every adversity comes the seed of an equivalent advantage. There never has been, and there probably never will be, an exception to this rule, because it is a part of nature's own plan, as described by Emerson in his essay on compensation. 2. The only real limitation is the one we establish in our own minds through lack of faith. Whatever limitations the mind establishes, the mind can also eliminate. I had been emphasizing these two statements for years, but now I was forced to meet a factual circumstance in the form of a newly born baby with an irreparable physical affliction which seemed to knock the very foundation from under both of these rules. It was the most dramatic experience of my life. On the one hand, I saw physical evidence of limitation which apparently no mind had created and no mind could eliminate. Also, I saw physical evidence of a newly born baby handicapped by a form of adversity which, as far as any reasoning mind could evaluate, could never yield the seed of an equivalent advantage. What advantage, some silent voice of mockery asked, could there possibly be to a human being born with no ears and condemned, therefore, to eternal deprivation of hearing and speech? The answer to that challenge was not forthcoming as far as my reasoning mind was concerned, but something inside me, some other form of intelligence with a more optimistic trend and an affinity for faith, answered the challenge in no uncertain terms. The answer assumed a form of thought which ran something like this. I do not know at this time what seed of advantage there is in being born without ears, but I do know there is an equivalent advantage, and I shall find it. I did not at the time of Blair's birth, nor at any time afterward, accept in my own mind the physical reality of a child condemned hopelessly to loss of hearing and speech. I moved on the theory, to me it was more than a theory, that sometime, somehow, I would find the seed of an advantage equivalent to the handicap brought over by the earless child, and that I would help him cause the seed to germinate and grow to some practical advantage sufficient to compensate him for his lack of ears. As this dramatic story is unfolded, you will observe, as clearly as you can see your own face in a mirror, that 1. I established in my own mind the mental image of a condition that would give Blair the use of hearing and speech, and 2. This image was taken over by some unknown natural law and translated into a physical reality. The evidence is indisputable, and fortunately it is of such a nature that no one is under the necessity of accepting my statements as the only means of verifying the facts concerning the case. No fewer than 50 other people, consisting of doctors who examined Blair from time to time, teachers who gave him instruction in school, and other close associates and relatives, are as familiar as I with all but one important feature of the case. I am the only person who created a mental impulse of thought at the time of Blair's birth, which reflected a correction of his deficiency, and I am the only person who nursed that thought continuously through faith until it found a way to manifest itself in physical form. You will have to accept my word for this part of the story. Everything else is amply corroborated. While Blair was a child in arms, there was no indication that he could hear. In fact, there was every indication that he could not. I have reference now to the first few months after his birth. When he was about 6 months old, his mother made the astonishing discovery that she could awaken him by speaking very gently, just above his head. From that time on, his hearing began to improve noticeably, until finally he could hear the sound of one's voice, although he made no attempt to talk until he was past 2 years of age. About that time, I discovered he could hear much better when I placed my lips against the side of his head when I spoke. Acting on this lead, I began to practice talking to him with my lips touching his head. Remember, this was long before the modern use of bone conduction, which is now employed so effectively by the manufacturers of hearing aids. One day I noticed that Blair seemed almost hypnotized by the sound of the Victrola, so I picked him up and placed his head against the sounding board. This caused him to let out a series of gurgling sounds, which resembled an attempt to laugh. After that, I equipped the Victrola so he could reach it, and he soon learned to operate the machine himself. He was so fascinated that he often stood by it and played one selection after another for hours at a time. Meanwhile, Blair was under the constant attention and observation of a noted ear specialist in Chicago, who expressed amazement at the child's ability to hear at all. This case was so puzzling that the doctor called in a group of the best-known ear specialists, and between them, they took many types of X-ray pictures of the child's skull in their endeavor to unravel the secret of his hearing. These examinations were continued at intervals of every few months, until Blair reached the age of 9. Then the doctor operated on one side of the child's head for the purpose of learning what, if anything, in the way of hearing equipment, was under the skin. We learned then, for the first time, that there was no opening in the skull for the canal, and not any sign of ear equipment. This discovery made the case more of a puzzle than ever. Nothing like it had ever been known in the annals of medical science. There had been other cases of children born without ears, but none of them had developed hearing ability. This was the feature of the case which had, and still has, the doctors puzzled. After an X-ray examination of Blair's skull, made by another noted ear specialist from New York City, he reported to me.